in the back of the car, and you wouldn't even talk to us. I was thinking hard then.
That's what Mom said.
He was thinking hard. The crushing teaching load was bad enough, but what for him was far worse was that he understood in his precise analytic way that the subject he was teaching was undoubtedly the most unprecise, unanalytic, amorphous area in the entire Church of Reason. That's why he was thinking so hard. To a methodical, laboratory-trained mind, rhetoric is just completely hopeless. It's like a huge Sargasso Sea of stagnated logic. What you're supposed to do in most freshman rhetoric courses is to read a little essay or short story, discuss how the writer has done certain little things to achieve certain little effects, and then have the students write an imitative little essay or short story to see if they can do the same little things. He tried this over and over again, but it never gelled. The students seldom achieved anything, as a result of this calculated mimicry, that was remotely close to the models he'd given them. More often, their writing got worse. It seemed as though every rule he honestly tried to discover with them and learn with them was so full of exceptions and contradictions and qualifications and confusions that he wished he'd never come across the rule in the first place. A student would always ask how the rule would apply in a certain special circumstance. Phaedrus would then have the choice of trying to fake through a made-up explanation of how it worked, or follow the selfless route and say what he really thought. And what he really thought was that the rule was pasted on to the writing after the writing was all done. It was post hoc, after the fact, instead of prior to the fact. And he became convinced that all the writers the students were supposed to mimic wrote without rules, putting down whatever sounded right, then going back to see if it still sounded right, and changing it if it didn't. There were some who apparently wrote with calculating premeditation, because that's the way their product looked. But that seemed to him to be a very poor way to look. It had a certain syrup, as Gertrude Stein once said, but it didn't pour. But how are you to teach something that isn't premeditated? It was a seemingly impossible requirement. He just took the text and commented on it in an unpremeditated way and hoped the students would get something from that. It wasn't satisfactory. There it was up ahead. Tension hits, the same stomach feeling as we walked toward it. Do you remember that building? That's where you used to teach. Why are we going here?
I don't know. I just wanted to see it.
Not many people seem to be around. There wouldn't be, of course. Summer session is on now. Huge and strange gables over old dark brown brick. A beautiful building, really. The only one that really seems to belong here. Old stone stairway up to the doors. Stairs cupped by wear from millions of footsteps. Why are we going inside?
Shh. Just don't say anything now.
I open the great heavy outside door and enter. Inside are more stairs, worn and wooden. They creak underfoot and smell of 100 years of sweeping and waxing. Halfway up, I stop and listen. There's no sound at all. Chris whispers, "Why are we here?" I just shake my head. I hear a car go by outside. Chris whispers,
"I don't like it here. It's scary in here."
"Go outside, then," I say.
"You come, too."
"Later."
"No, now."
He looks at me and sees I'm staying. His look is so frightened I'm about to change my mind, but then suddenly his expression breaks, and he turns and runs down the stairs and out the door before I can follow him. The big, heavy door closes down below, and I'm all alone here now. I listen for some sound. Of whom? Of him? I listen for a long time. The floorboards have an eerie creak as I move down the corridor, and they are accompanied by an eerie thought that it is him. In this place, he is the reality, and I am the ghost. On one of the classroom doorknobs, I see his hand rest for a moment, then slowly turn the knob, then push the door open. The room inside is waiting, exactly as remembered, as if he were here now. He is here now. He's aware of everything I see. Everything jumps forth and vibrates with recall. The long, dark green chalkboards on either side are flaked and in need of repair, just as they were. The chalk, never any chalk except little stubs in the trough, is still here. Beyond the blackboard are the windows, and through them are the mountains he watched, meditatively, on days when the students were writing. He would sit by the radiator with a stub of chalk in one hand and stare out the window at the mountains, interrupted occasionally by a student who asked, "Do we have to do..." And he would turn and answer whatever thing it was, and there was a oneness he had never known before. This was a place where he was received as himself. Not as what he could be or should be, but as himself. A place all receptive, listening. He gave everything to it. This wasn't one room. This was a thousand rooms, changing each day with the storms and snows and patterns of clouds on the mountains, with each class, and even with each student. No 2 hours were ever alike, and it was always a mystery to him what the next one would bring. My sense of time has been lost when I hear a creaking of steps in the hall. It becomes louder, then stops at the entrance to this classroom. The knob turns. The door opens. A woman looks in. She has an aggressive face, as if she intended to catch someone here. She appears to be in her late 20s, is not very pretty. "I thought I saw someone," she says. "I thought..." She looks puzzled. She comes inside the room and walks toward me. She looks at me more closely. Now the aggressive look vanishes, slowly changing to wonder. She looks astonished. "Oh, my God," she says. "Is it you?" I don't recognize her at all. Nothing. She calls my name, and I nod, "Yes, it's me."
"You've come back."
I shake my head. "Just for these few minutes." She continues to look until it becomes embarrassing. Now she becomes aware of this herself and asks,
"May I sit down for a moment?"
The timid way she asks this indicates she may have been a student of his. She sits down in one of the front row chairs. Her hand, which bears no wedding ring, is trembling. I really am a ghost. Now she becomes embarrassed herself.
"How long are you staying?" "No, I asked you that."
I fill in, "I'm staying with Bob DeWeese for a few days and then heading west. I had some time to spend in town and thought I'd see how the college looked."
"Oh," she says, "I'm glad you did. It's changed. We've all changed. So much since you left."
There's another embarrassing pause.
"We heard you were in the hospital."
"Yes," I say. There is more embarrassed silence. That she doesn't pursue it means she probably knows why. She hesitates some more, searches for something to say. This is getting hard to bear.
"Where are you teaching?" she finally asks.
"I'm not teaching anymore," I say. "I've stopped." She looks incredulous.
"You've stopped?"
She frowns and looks at me again, as if to verify that she is really talking to the right person.
"You can't do that."
"Yes, you can." She shakes her head in disbelief.
"Not you?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"That's all over for me now. I'm doing other things." I keep wondering who she is, and her expression looks equally baffled.
"But that's just..."
The sentence drops off. She tries again.
"You're just being completely..."
But this sentence fails too. The next word is crazy, but she has caught herself both times. She realizes something, bites her lip, and looks mortified. I'd say something if I could, but there's no place to start. I'm about to tell her I don't know her, but she stands up and says,
"I must go now."
I think she sees I don't know her. She goes to the door, says goodbye quickly and perfunctorily, and as it closes, her footsteps go quickly, almost at a run, down the hall. The outer door of the building closes, and the classroom is as silent as before, except for a kind of psychic eddy current she has left behind. The room is completely modified by it. Now it contains only the backwash of her presence, and what it was I came here to see has vanished. Good, I think, standing up again. I'm glad to have visited this room, but I don't think I'll ever want to see it again. I'd rather fix motorcycles, and one's waiting. On the way out, I open one more door compulsively. There on the wall I see something which sends a spine-tingling feeling along my neck. It's a painting. I've had no recollection of it, but now I know he bought it and put it there. And suddenly I know it's not a painting, it's a print of a painting he ordered from New York, and which Deweese had frowned at because it was a print, and prints are of art and not art themselves, a distinction he didn't recognize at the time. But the print, Feiniger's Church of Minor Rites, had an appeal to him that was irrelevant to the art in that its subject, a kind of Gothic cathedral created from semi-abstract lines and planes and colors and shades, seemed to reflect his mind's vision of the Church of Reason, and that was why he'd put it here. All this comes back now. This was his office. A find. This is the room I am looking for. I step inside, and an avalanche of memory, loosened by the jolt of the print, begins to come down. The light on the print comes from a miserable cramped window in the adjacent wall, through which he looked out onto and across the valley onto the Madison Range, and watched the storms come in, and while watching this valley before me now through this window here, now started the whole thing, the whole madness, right here. This is the exact spot. And that door leads to Sarah's office. Sarah. Now it comes down. Sarah came trotting by with her watering pot between those two doors, going from the corridor to her office, and she said, I hope you are teaching quality to your students. This, in a la-di-da sing-song voice of a lady in her final year before retirement, about to water her plants. That was the moment it all started. That was the seed crystal. Seed crystal. A powerful fragment of memory comes back now. The laboratory. Organic chemistry. He was working with an extremely supersaturated solution when something similar had happened. A supersaturated solution is one in which the saturation point, at which no more material will dissolve, has been exceeded. This can occur because the saturation point becomes higher as the temperature of the solution is increased. When you dissolve the material at a high temperature and then cool the solution, the material sometimes doesn't crystallize out because the molecules don't know how. They require something to get them started. A seed crystal, or a grain of dust, or even a sudden scratch or tap on the surrounding glass. He walked to the water tap to cool the solution, but never got there. Before his eyes, as he walked, he saw a star of crystalline material in the solution appear, and then grow suddenly and radiantly until it filled the entire vessel. He saw it grow. Where before was only clear liquid, there was now a mass so solid he could turn the vessel upside down and nothing would come out. The one sentence, I hope you are teaching quality to your students, was said to him, and within a matter of a few months, growing so fast you could almost see it grow, came an enormous, intricate, highly structured mass of thought, formed as if by magic. I don't know what he replied to her when she said this. Probably nothing. She would be back and forth behind his chair many times each day to get to and from her office. Sometimes she stopped with a word or two of apology about the interruption, sometimes with a fragment of news, and he was accustomed to this as a part of office life. I know that she came by a second time and asked, "Are you really teaching quality this quarter?" And he nodded, and looked back from his chair for a second and said, "Definitely." And she trotted on. He was working on lecture notes at the time, and was in a state of complete depression about them. What was depressing was that the text was one of the most rational texts available on the subject of rhetoric, and it still didn't seem right. Moreover, he had access to the authors, who were members of the department. He had asked and listened and talked and agreed with their answers in a rational way, but somehow still wasn't satisfied with them. The text started with the premise that if rhetoric is to be taught at all at a university level, it should be taught as a branch of reason, not as a mystic art. Therefore, it emphasized a mastery of the rational foundations of communication in order to understand rhetoric. Elementary was introduced, elementary stimulus-response theory was brought in, and from these a progression was made to an understanding of how to develop an essay. For the first year of teaching, Phaedrus had been fairly content with this framework. He felt there was something wrong with it, but that the wrongness was not in this application of reason to rhetoric. The wrongness was in the old ghost of his dreams, rationality itself. He recognized it as the same wrongness that had been troubling him for years, and for which he had no solutions. He just felt that no writer ever learned to write by this squarish, by-the-numbers, objective, methodical approach. Yet that was all rationality offered, and there was nothing to do about it without being irrational. And if there was one thing he had a clear mandate to do in this Church of Reason, it was to be rational. So he had to let it go at that. A few days later, when Sarah trotted by again, she stopped and said, "I'm so happy you're teaching quality this quarter. Hardly anybody is these days." "Well, I am," he said. "I'm definitely making a point of it." "Good," she said, and trotted on. He returned to his notes, but it wasn't long before thought about them was interrupted by a recall of her strange remark. What the hell was she talking about? Quality? Of course he was teaching quality. Who wasn't? He continued with the notes. Another thing that depressed him was prescriptive rhetoric, which supposedly had been done away with, but was still around. This was the old slap on the fingers if your modifiers were caught dangling stuff. Correct spelling, correct punctuation, correct grammar. Hundreds of itsy-bitsy rules for itsy-bitsy people. No one could remember all that stuff and concentrate on what he was trying to write about. It was all table manners, not derived from any sense of kindness or decency or humanity, but originally from an egotistic desire to look like gentlemen and ladies. Gentlemen and ladies had good table manners and spoke and wrote grammatically. It was what identified one with the upper classes. In Montana, however, it didn't have this effect at all. It identified one instead as a stuck-up Eastern ass. There was a minimum prescriptive rhetoric requirement in the department, but like the other teachers, he scrupulously avoided any defense of prescriptive rhetoric other than as a requirement of the college. Soon the thought interrupted again. Quality? There was something irritating, even angering, about that question. He thought about it, and then thought some more, and then looked out the window, and then thought about it some more. Quality? 4 hours later, he still sat there with his feet on the window ledge and stared out into what had become a dark sky. The phone rang, and it was his wife calling to find out what had happened. He told her he would be home soon, but then forgot about this and everything else. It wasn't until 3 o'clock in the morning that he wearily confessed to himself that he didn't have a clue as to what quality was, picked up his briefcase, and headed home. Most people would have forgotten about quality at this point, or just left it hanging suspended because they were getting nowhere and had other things to do. But he was so despondent about his own inability to teach what he believed, he really didn't give a damn about whatever else it was he was supposed to do. And when he woke up the next morning, there was quality staring him in the face. 3 hours of sleep, and he was so tired he knew he wouldn't be up to giving a lecture that day, and besides, his notes had never been completed. So he wrote on the blackboard, "Write a 350-word essay answering the question, what is quality in thought and statement?" Then he sat by the radiator while they wrote and thought about quality himself. At the end of the hour, no one seemed to have finished, so he allowed the students to take their papers home. This class didn't meet again for 2 days, and that gave him some time to think about the question some more, too. During that interim, he saw some of the students walking between classes, nodded to them, and got looks of anger and fear in return. He guessed they were having the same trouble he was. Quality. You know what it is, yet you don't know what it is. But that's self-contradictory. But some things are better than others, that is, they have more quality. But when you try to say what the quality is, apart from the things that have it, it all goes poof. There's nothing to talk about. But if you can't say what quality is, how do you know what it is? Or how do you know that it even exists? If no one knows what it is, then for all practical purposes, it doesn't exist at all. But for all practical purposes, it really does exist. What else are the grades based on? Why else would people pay fortunes for some things and throw others in the trash pile? Obviously, some things are better than others, but what's the betterness? So round and round you go, spinning mental wheels and nowhere finding any place to get traction. What the hell is quality? What is it? Part 3, Chapter 16. Chris and I have had a good night's sleep, and this morning have packed the backpacks carefully, and now have been going up the mountainside for about an hour. The forest here at the bottom of the canyon is mostly pine, with a few aspen and broad-leafed shrubs. Steep canyon walls rise way above us on both sides. Occasionally, the trail opens into a patch of sunlight and grass that edges the canyon stream, but soon it re-enters the deep shade of the pines. The earth of the trail is covered with a soft, springy duff of pine needles. It is very quiet here. Mountains like these and travelers in the mountains and events that happen to them here are found not only in Zen literature, but in the tales of every major religion. The allegory of a physical mountain for the spiritual one that stands between each soul and its goal is an easy and natural one to make. Like those in the valley behind us, most people stand inside of the spiritual mountains all their lives and never enter them, being content to listen to others who have been there and thus avoid the hardships. Some travel into the mountains accompanied by experienced guides who know the best and least dangerous routes by which they arrive at their destination. Still others, inexperienced and untrusting, attempt to make their own routes. Few of these are successful, but occasionally some, by sheer will and luck and grace, do make it. Once there, they become more aware than any of the others that there's no single or fixed number of routes. There are as many routes as there are individual souls. I want to talk now about Phaedrus's exploration into the meaning of the term quality, an exploration which he saw as a route through the mountains of the spirit. As best I can puzzle it out, there were two distinct phases. In the first phase, he made no attempt at a rigid, systematic definition of what he was talking about. This was a happy, fulfilling, and creative phase. It lasted most of the time he taught at the school back in the valley behind us. The second phase emerged as a result of normal intellectual criticism of his lack of definition of what he was talking about. In this phase, he made systematic, rigid statements about what quality is and worked out an enormous, hierarchic structure of thought to support them. He literally had to move heaven and earth to arrive at this systematic understanding, and when he was done, felt he'd achieved an explanation of existence, and our consciousness of it, better than any that had existed before. If it was truly a new route over the mountain, it's certainly a needed one. For more than 3 centuries now, the old routes common in this hemisphere have been undercut and almost washed out by the natural erosion and change of the shape of the mountain wrought by scientific truth. The early climbers established paths that were on firm ground with an accessibility that appealed to all, but today the western routes are all but closed because of dogmatic inflexibility in the face of change. To doubt the literal meaning of the words of Jesus or Moses incurs hostility from most people, but it's just a fact that if Jesus or Moses were to appear today, unidentified, with the same message he spoke many years ago, his mental stability would be challenged. This isn't because what Jesus or Moses said was untrue, or because modern society is in error, but simply because the route they chose to reveal to others has lost relevance and comprehensibility. Heaven above fades from meaning when space-age consciousness asks, "Where is above?" But the fact that the old routes have tended, because of language rigidity, to lose their everyday meaning and become almost closed doesn't mean that the mountain is no longer there. It's there, and will be there, as long as consciousness exists. Phaedrus's second metaphysical phase was a total disaster. Before the electrodes were attached to his head, he'd lost everything tangible. Money, property, children. Even his rights as a citizen had been taken away from him by order of the court. All he had left was his one crazy lone dream of quality, a map of a route across the mountain for which he had sacrificed everything. Then, after the electrodes were attached, he lost that. I will never know all that was in his head at that time, nor will anyone else. What's left now is just fragments, debris, scattered notes, which can be pieced together, but which leave huge areas unexplained. When I first discovered this debris, I felt like some agricultural peasant near the outskirts of, say, Athens, who occasionally, and without much surprise, plows up stones that have strange designs on them. I knew that these were part of some larger overall design that had existed in the past, but it was far beyond my comprehension. At first, I deliberately avoided them, paid no attention to them because I knew these stones had caused some kind of trouble I should avoid. But I could see even then that they were part of a huge structure of thought, and I was curious about it in a secret sort of way. Later, when I developed more confidence in my immunity to his affliction, I became interested in this debris in a more positive way, and began to jot down the fragments amorphically, that is, without regard to form, in the order in which they occurred to me. Many of these amorphic statements have been supplied by friends. There are thousands of them now, and although only a small portion of them can fit into this Chautauqua is clearly based on them. It is probably a long way from what he thought. When trying to recreate a whole pattern by deduction from fragments, I am bound to commit errors and put down inconsistencies, for which I must ask some indulgence. In many cases, the fragments are ambiguous. A number of different conclusions could be drawn. If something is wrong, there's a good chance that the error isn't in what he thought, but in my reconstruction of it. And a better reconstruction can later be found. A whirr sounds, and a partridge disappears through the trees.
"Did you see it?" says Chris.
"Yes," I say back.
"What was it?"
"A partridge."
"How do you know?"
"They rock back and forth like that when they fly," I say. I'm not sure of this, but it sounds right. "They stay close to the ground, too."
"Oh,"
says Chris. And we continue hiking. The rays of the sun create a cathedral effect through the pines. Today now I want to take up the first phase of his journey into quality, the non-metaphysical phase, and this will be pleasant. It's nice to start journeys pleasantly, even when you know they won't end that way. Using his class notes as reference material, I want to reconstruct the way in which quality became a working concept for him in the teaching of rhetoric. His second phase, the metaphysical one, was tenuous and speculative, but this first phase, in which he simply taught rhetoric, was by all accounts solid and pragmatic, and probably deserves to be judged on its own merits, independently of the second phase. He'd been innovating extensively. He'd been having trouble with students who had nothing to say. At first he thought it was laziness, but later it became apparent that it wasn't. They just couldn't think of anything to say. One of them, a girl with strong-lensed glasses, wanted to write a 500-word essay about the United States. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 5, Side 2. One of them, a girl with strong-lensed glasses, wanted to write a 500-word essay about the United States. He was used to the sinking feeling that comes from statements like this, and suggested without disparagement that she narrow it down to just Bozeman. When the paper came due, she didn't have it and was quite upset. She had tried and tried, but she just couldn't think of anything to say. He had already discussed her with her previous instructors, and they'd confirmed his impressions of her. She was very serious, disciplined, and hard-working, but extremely dull. Not a spark of creativity in her anywhere. Her eyes, behind the thick-lensed glasses, were the eyes of a drudge. She wasn't bluffing him. She really couldn't think of anything to say, and was upset by her inability to do as she was told. It just stumped him. Now he couldn't think of anything to say. A silence occurred, and then a peculiar answer. "Narrow it down to the main street of Bozeman." It was a stroke of insight. She nodded dutifully and went out. But just before her next class, She came back in real distress, tears this time, distress that had obviously been there for a long time. She still couldn't think of anything to say, and couldn't understand why, if she couldn't think of anything about all of Bozeman, she should be able to think of something about just one street. He was furious. "You're not looking," he said. A memory came back of his own dismissal from the university for having too much to say. For every fact, there is an infinity of hypotheses. The more you look, the more you see. She really wasn't looking, and yet somehow didn't understand this. He told her angrily, "Narrow it down to the front of one building on Main Street of Bozeman. The Opera House. Start with the upper left-hand brick." Her eyes, behind the thick-lensed glasses, opened wide. She came in the next class with a puzzled look and handed him a 5,000-word essay on the front of the Opera House on the Main Street of Bozeman, Montana. "I sat in the hamburger stand across the street," she said, "and started writing about the first brick and the second brick, and then by the third brick, it all started to come and I couldn't stop. They thought I was crazy, and they kept kidding me. But here it all is. I don't understand it." Neither did he. But on long walks through the streets of town, he thought about it, and concluded she was evidently stopped with the same kind of blockage that had paralyzed him on his first day of teaching. She was blocked because she was trying to repeat, in her writing, things she had already heard, just as on the first day he had tried to repeat things he had already decided to say. She couldn't think of anything to write about Bozeman because she couldn't recall anything she had heard worth repeating. She was strangely unaware that she could look and see freshly for herself as she wrote, without primary regard for what had been said before. The narrowing down to one brick destroyed the blockage because it was so obvious she had to do some original and direct seeing. He experimented further. In one class, he had everyone write all hour about the back of his thumb. Everyone gave him funny looks at the beginning of the hour, but everyone did it, and there wasn't a single complaint about nothing to say. In another class, he changed the subject from the thumb to a coin, and got a full hour's writing from every student. In other classes, it was the same. Some asked, "Do you have to write about both sides?" Once they got into the idea of seeing directly for themselves, they also saw there was no limit to the amount they could say. It was a confidence-building assignment, too, because what they wrote, even though seemingly trivial, was nevertheless their own thing, not a mimicking of someone else's. Classes where he used that coin exercise were always less balky and more interested. As a result of his experiments, he concluded that imitation was a real evil that had to be broken before real rhetoric teaching could begin. This imitation seemed to be an external compulsion. Little children didn't have it. It seemed to come later on, possibly as a result of school itself. That sounded right, and the more he thought about it, the more right it sounded. Schools teach you to imitate. If you don't imitate what the teacher wants, you get a bad grade. Here in college, it was more sophisticated, of course. You were supposed to imitate the teacher in such a way as to convince the teacher you were not imitating, but taking the essence of the instruction and going ahead with it on your own. That got you A's. Originality, on the other hand, could get you anything, from A to F. The whole grading system cautioned against it. He discussed this with a professor of psychology who lived next door to him, an extremely imaginative teacher, who said, "Right. Eliminate the whole degree and grading system, and then you'll get real education." Phaedrus thought about this, and when weeks later a very bright student couldn't think of a subject for a term paper that was still on his mind, so he gave it to her as a topic. She didn't like the topic at first, but agreed to take it anyway. Within a week she was talking about it to everyone, and within 2 weeks had worked up a superb paper. The class she delivered it to didn't have the advantage of 2 weeks to think about the subject, however, and was quite hostile to the whole idea of eliminating grades and degrees. This didn't slow her down at all. Her tone took on an old-time religious fervor. She begged the other students to listen, to understand this was really right. "I'm not saying this," she said, and glanced at Phaedrus. "It's for you." Her pleading tone, her religious fervor, greatly impressed him, along with the fact that her college entrance exams had placed her in the upper 1% of the class. During the next quarter, when teaching persuasive writing, he chose this topic as a demonstrator, a piece of persuasive writing he worked up by himself, day by day, in front of and with the help of the class. He used the demonstrator to avoid talking in terms of principles of composition, all of which he had deep doubts about. He felt that by exposing classes to his own sentences as he made them, with all the misgivings and hang-ups and erasures, he would give a more honest picture of what writing was like than by spending class time picking nits in completed student work or holding up the completed work of masters for emulation. This time, he developed the argument that the whole grading system and degree should be eliminated, and to make it something that truly involved the students in what they were hearing, he withheld all grades during the quarter. Just up above the top of the ridge, the snow can be seen now. On foot, it's many days away, though. The rocks below it are too steep for a direct hiking climb, particularly with the heavy loads we are carrying, and Chris is way too young for any kind of ropes and pitons stuff. We must cross over the forested ridge we are now approaching, enter another canyon, follow it to its end, and then come back at an upward angle along to the ridge. 3 days hard to the snow, 4 days easy. If we don't show up in 9, Deweese will start looking for us. We stop for a rest, sit down and brace against a tree so that we don't topple over backward from the packs. After a while, I reach around over my shoulder, take the machete from the top of my pack, and hand it to Chris. See those two aspens over there, the straight ones, at the edge? I point to them. Cut those down about a foot from the ground. Why? We'll need them later for hiking sticks and tent poles. Chris takes the machete, starts to rise, but then settles back again. You cut them, he says. So I take the machete and go over and cut the poles. They both cut neatly in one swing, except for the final strip of bark, which I sever with the back hook of the machete. Up in the rocks, you need the poles for balancing, and the pine up above is no good for poles, and this is about the last of the aspen here. It bothers me a little, though, that Chris is turning down work. Not a good sign in the mountains. A short rest, and then on we go. It'll take a while to get used to this load. There's a negative reaction to all the weight. As we go on, though, it'll become more natural. Phaedrus's argument for the abolition of the degree and grading system produced a nonplussed or negative reaction in all but a few students at first, since it seemed, on first judgment, to destroy the whole university system. One student laid it wide open when she said, with complete candor, "Of course you can't eliminate the degree and grading system. After all, that's what we're here for." She spoke the complete truth. The idea that the majority of students attend a university for an education independent of the degree and grades is a little hypocrisy everyone is happier not to expose. Occasionally, some students do arrive for an education, but rote and the mechanical nature of the institution soon converts them to a less idealistic attitude. The demonstrator was an argument that elimination of grades and degrees would destroy this hypocrisy. Rather than deal with generalities, it dealt with a specific career of an imaginary student who more or less typified what was found in the classroom, a student completely conditioned to work for a grade, rather than for the knowledge the grade was supposed to represent. Such a student, the demonstrator hypothesized, would go to his first class, get his first assignment, and probably do it out of habit. He might go to his second and third as well. But eventually, the novelty of the course would wear off, and because his academic life was not his only life, the pressure of other obligations or desires would create circumstances where he just would not be able to get an assignment in. Since there was no degree or grading system, he would incur no penalty for this. Subsequent lectures, which presumed he'd completed the assignment, might be a little more difficult to understand, however, and this difficulty in turn might weaken his interest to a point where the next assignment, which he would find quite hard, would also be dropped. Again, no penalty. In time, his weaker and weaker understanding of what the lectures were about would make it more and more difficult for him to pay attention in class. Eventually, he would see he wasn't learning much, and facing the continual pressure of outside obligations, he would stop studying, feel guilty about this, and stop attending class. Again, no penalty would be attached. But what had happened? The student, with no hard feelings on anybody's part, would have flunked himself out. Good. This is what should have happened. He wasn't there for a real education in the first place, and had no real business there at all. A large amount of money and effort had been saved, and there would be no stigma of failure and ruin to haunt him the rest of his life. No bridges had been burned. The student's biggest problem was a slave mentality which had been built into him by years of carrot and whip grading. A mule mentality which said, "If you don't whip me, I won't work." He didn't get whipped. He didn't work. And the cart of civilization, which he supposedly was being trained to pull, was just going to have to creak along a little slower without him. This is a tragedy, however, only if you presume that the cart of civilization, the system, is pulled by mules. This is a common vocational location point of view, but it's not the church attitude. The church attitude is that civilization, or the system, or society, or whatever you want to call it, is best served not by mules, but by free men. The purpose of abolishing grades and degrees is not to punish mules, or to get rid of them, but to provide an environment in which that mule can turn into a free man. The hypothetical student, still a mule, would drift around for a while. He would get another kind of education, quite as valuable as the one he'd abandoned, in what used to be called the School of Hard Knocks. Instead of wasting money and time as a high-status mule, he would now have to get a job as a low-status mule, maybe as a mechanic. Actually, his real status would go up. He would be making a contribution for a change. Maybe that's what he would do for the rest of his life. Maybe he'd found his level. But don't count on it. In time, 6 months, 5 years perhaps, a change could easily begin to take place. He would become less and less satisfied with a kind of dumb day-to-day shop work. His creative intelligence, stifled by too much theory and too many grades in college, would now become reawakened by the boredom of the shop. Thousands of hours of frustrating mechanical problems would have made him more interested in machine design. He would like to design machinery himself. He'd think he could do a better job. He would try modifying a few engines, meet with success, look for more success, but feel blocked because he didn't have the theoretical information. He would discover that when before he felt stupid because of his lack of interest in theoretical information, he'd now find a brand of theoretical information which he'd have a lot of respect for, namely, mechanical engineering. So, he would come back to our degreeless and gradeless school, but with a difference. He'd no longer be a grade-motivated person. He'd be a knowledge-motivated person. He would need no external pushing to learn. His push would come from inside. He'd be a free man. He wouldn't need a lot of discipline to shape him up. In fact, if the instructors assigned him were slacking on the job, he would likely to shape them up by asking rude questions. He'd be there to learn something, would be paying to learn something, and they'd better come up with it. Motivation of this sort, once it catches hold, is a ferocious force, and in the gradeless, degreeless institution where our student would find himself, he wouldn't stop with rote engineering information. Physics and mathematics were going to come within his sphere of interest because he'd see he needed them. Metallurgy and electrical engineering would come up for attention. And, in the process of intellectual maturing that these abstract studies gave him, he would be likely to branch out into other theoretical areas that weren't directly related to machines, but had become a part of a newer, larger goal. This larger goal wouldn't be the imitation of education in universities today, glossed over and concealed by grades and degrees that give the appearance of something happening when, in fact, almost nothing is going on. It would be the real thing. Such was Phaedrus's demonstrator, his unpopular argument, and he worked on it all quarter long, building it up and modifying it, arguing for it, defending it. All quarter long, papers would go back to the students with comments, but no grades, although the grades were entered in a book. As I said before, at first almost everyone was sort of nonplussed. The majority probably figured they were stuck with some idealist who thought removal of grades would make them happier and thus work harder, when it was obvious that without grades, everyone would just loaf. Many of the students with A records in previous quarters were contemptuous and angry at first, but because of their acquired self-discipline, went ahead and did the work anyway. The B students and high C students missed some of the early assignments or turned in sloppy work. Many of the low C and D students didn't even show up for class. At this time, another teacher asked him what he was going to do about this lack of response. "Outweight them," he said. His lack of harshness puzzled the students at first, then made them suspicious. Some began to ask sarcastic questions. These received soft answers, and the lectures and speeches proceeded as usual, except with no grades. Then a hoped-for phenomenon began. During the third or fourth week, some of the A students began to get nervous and started to turn in superb work and hang around after class with questions that fished for some indication as to how they were doing. The B and high C students began to notice this and work a little and bring up the quality of their papers to a more usual level. The low C, D, and future Fs began to show up for class just to see what was going on. At mid-quarter, an even more hoped-for phenomenon took place. The A-rated students lost their nervousness and became active participants in everything that went on with a friendliness that was uncommon in a grade-getting class. At this point, the B and C students were in a panic and turned in stuff that looked as though they'd spent hours of painstaking work on it. The D's and F's turned in satisfactory assignments. In the final weeks of the quarter, a time when normally everyone knows what his grade will be and just sits back half asleep, Phaedrus was getting a kind of class participation that made other teachers take notice. The B's and C's had joined the A's in friendly, free-for-all discussion that made the class seem like a successful party. Only the D's and F's sat frozen in their chairs in a complete internal panic. The phenomenon of relaxation and friendliness was explained later by a couple of students who told him, "A lot of us got together outside of class to try to figure out how to beat this system. Everyone decided the best way was just to figure you were going to fail, and then go ahead and do what you could anyway. Then you start to relax. Otherwise, you go out of your mind." The students added that once you got used to it, it wasn't so bad. You were more interested in the subject matter, but repeated that it wasn't easy to get used to. At the end of the quarter, the students were asked to write an essay evaluating the system. None of them knew at the time of writing what his or her grade would be. 54% opposed it, 37% favored it, 9% were neutral. On the basis of one man, one vote, the system was very unpopular. The majority of students definitely wanted their grades as they went along. But when Phaedrus broke down the returns according to the grades that were in his book, and the grades were not out of line with grades predicted by previous classes and entrance evaluations, another story was told. The A students were 2-1 in favor of the system. The B and C students were evenly divided, and the D's and F's were unanimously opposed. This surprising result supported a hunch he had had for a long time, that the brighter, more serious students were the least desirous of grades, possibly because they were more interested in the subject matter of the course, whereas the duller, lazy students were the most desirous of grades, possibly because grades told them if they were getting by. As Deweese said, from here straight south you can go 75 miles through nothing but forests and snow without ever encountering a road, although there are roads to the east and west. I've arranged it so that if things work out badly at the end of the second day, we'll be near a road that can get us back fast. Chris doesn't know this, and it would hurt his YMCA camp sense of adventure to tell him. But after enough trips into the high country, the YMCA desire for adventure diminishes, and the more substantial benefits of cutting down risks appear. This country can be dangerous. You take one bad step in a million, sprain an ankle, and then you find out how far from civilization you really are. This is apparently a seldom-entered canyon this far up. After another hour of hiking, we see that the trail is about gone. Phaedrus thought withholding grades was good, according to his notes, but he didn't give it scientific value. In a true experiment, you keep constant every cause you can think of except one, and then see what the effects are of varying that one cause. In the classroom, you can never do this. Student knowledge, student attitude, teacher attitude, all change from all kinds of causes which are uncontrollable and mostly unknowable. Also, the observer in this case is himself one of the causes, and can never judge his effects without altering his effects. So he didn't attempt to draw any hard conclusions from all this. He just went ahead and did what he liked. The movement from this to his inquiry into quality took place because of a sinister aspect of grading that the withholding of grades exposed. Grades really cover up failure to teach. A bad instructor can go through an entire quarter, leaving absolutely nothing memorable in the minds of his class, curve out the scores on an irrelevant test, and leave the impression that some have learned and some have not. But if the grades are removed, the class is forced to wonder each day what it's really learning. The questions, what's being taught, what's the goal, how do the lectures and assignments accomplish the goal, become ominous. The removal of grades exposes a huge and frightening vacuum. What was Phaedrus trying to do, anyway? This question became more and more imperative as he went on. The answer that had seemed right when he started now made less and less sense. He had wanted his students to become creative by deciding for themselves what was good writing, instead of asking him all the time. The real purpose of withholding grades was to force them to look within themselves, the only place they would ever get a really right answer. But now this made no sense. If they already knew what was good and bad, there was no reason for them to take the course in the first place. The fact that they were there as students presumed they did not know what was good or bad. That was his job as instructor, to tell them what was good or bad. The whole idea of individual creativity and expression in the classroom was really basically opposed to the whole idea of the university. For many of the students, this withholding created a Kafkaesque situation in which they saw they were to be punished for failure to do something, but no one would tell them what they were supposed to do. They looked within themselves and saw nothing, and looked at Phaedrus and saw nothing, and just sat there helpless, not knowing what to do. The vacuum was deadly. One girl suffered a nervous breakdown. You can withhold grades and sit there and create a goalless vacuum. You have to provide some goal for a class to work toward that will fill that vacuum. This he wasn't doing. He couldn't. He could think of no possible way he could tell them what they should work toward without falling back into the trap of authoritarian, didactic teaching. But how can you put on the blackboard the mysterious internal goal of each creative person? The next quarter he dropped the whole idea and went back to regular grading, discouraged, confused, feeling he was right, but somehow it had come out all wrong. When spontaneity and individuality and really good original stuff occurred in a classroom, it was in spite of the instruction, not because of it. This seemed to make sense. He was ready to resign. Teaching dull conformity to hateful students wasn't what he wanted to do. He'd heard that Reed College in Oregon withheld grades until graduation, and during the summer vacation he went there, but was told the faculty was divided on the value of withholding grades and that no one was tremendously happy about the system. During the rest of the summer, his mood became depressed and lazy. He and his wife camped a lot in those mountains. She asked why he was so silent all the time, but he couldn't say why. He was just stopped, waiting, for that missing seed crystal of thought that would suddenly solidify everything. Chapter 17. It's looking bad for Chris. For a while he was way ahead of me, and now he sits under a tree and rests. He doesn't look at me, and that's how I know it's bad. I sit down next to him, and his expression is distant. His face is flushed, and I can see he's exhausted. We sit and listen to the wind through the pines. I know eventually he'll get up and keep going, but he doesn't know this and is afraid to face the possibility that his fear creates, that he may not be able to climb the mountain at all. I remember something Phaedrus had written about these mountains, and tell it to Chris now. Years ago, I tell him, your mother and I were at the timberline not so far from here, and we camped near a lake with a marsh on one side. He doesn't look up, but he's listening. At about dawn, we heard falling rocks, and we thought it must be an animal, except that animals don't usually clatter around. Then I heard a squishing sound in the marsh, and we were really wide awake. I got out of the sleeping bag slowly, and got our revolver from my jacket and crouched by a tree. Now Chris's attention is distracted from his own problems. There was another squish, I say. I thought it could be horses with dudes packing in, but not at this hour. Another squish. And a loud galumph. That's no horse. And a galumph. And a galumph. And there, in the dim gray light of dawn, coming straight for me through the muck of the marsh, was the biggest bull moose I ever saw. Horns as wide as a man is tall. Next to the grizzly, the most dangerous animal in the mountains. Some say the worst. Chris's eyes are bright again. Galumph! I cocked the hammer on the revolver, thinking a .38 special wasn't very much for a moose. Galumph! He didn't see me. Galumph! I couldn't get out of his way. Your mother was in the sleeping bag right in his path. Galumph! What a giant! Galumph! He's 10 yards away! Galumph! I stand up and take aim. Galumph! 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 He stops, 3 yards away, and sees me. The gun sights lie right between his eyes. We're motionless. I reach around into my pack and get out some cheese. Then what happened? Chris asks. Wait until I cut off some of this cheese. I remove my hunting knife and hold the cheese wrapper so that my fingers don't get on it. I slice out a quarter-inch hunk and hold it out for him. He takes it. Then what happened? I watch until he takes his first bite. That bull moose looked at me for what must have been 5 seconds. Then he looked down at your mother. Then he looked at me again, and at the revolver which was practically lying on top of his big round nose. And then he smiled and slowly walked away. Oh, says Chris. He looks disappointed. Normally when they're confronted like that, they'll charge, I say. But he just thought it was a nice morning, and we were there first, so why make trouble? And that's why he smiled. Can they smile? No, but it looked that way. I put the cheese away and add, later on that day we were jumping from boulder to boulder down the side of a slope. I was about to land on a great big brown boulder, when all of a sudden the great big brown boulder jumped into the air and ran off into the woods. It was the same moose. I think that moose must have been pretty sick of us that day. I help Chris get to his feet. You were going a little too fast, I say. Now the mountainside's becoming steep, and we have to go slowly. If you go too fast, you get winded, and when you get winded, you get dizzy, and that weakens your spirit, and you think, I can't do it. So go slow for a while. I'll stay behind you, he says. Okay. We walk now away from the stream we were following, up the canyon side at the shallowest angle I can find. Mountains should be climbed with as little effort as possible, and without desire. The reality of your own nature should determine the speed. If you become restless, speed up. If you become winded, slow down. You climb the mountain in an equilibrium between restlessness and exhaustion. Then, when you're no longer thinking ahead, each footstep isn't just a means to an end, but a unique event in itself. This leaf has jagged edges. This rock looks loose. From this place, the snow is less visible, even though closer. These are things you should notice anyway. To live only for some future goal is shallow. It's the sides of the mountain which sustain life, not the top. Here's where things grow. But of course, without the top, you can't have any sides. It's the top that defines the sides. So on we go. We have a long way, no hurry, just one step after the next, with a little Chautauqua for entertainment. Mental reflection is so much more interesting than TV, it's a shame more people don't switch over to it. They probably think what they hear is unimportant, but it never is. There's a large fragment concerning Phaedrus's first class after he gave that assignment on what is quality in thought and statement. The atmosphere was explosive. Almost everyone seemed as frustrated and angered as he had been by the question. How are we supposed to know what quality is? They said. You're supposed to tell us. Then he told them he couldn't figure it out either, and really wanted to know. He had assigned it in the hope that somebody would come up with a good answer. That ignited it. A roar of indignation shook the room. Before the commotion had